मनोबुद्ध्यहङ्काररचितानि नाहं न च श्रोत्रजिह्वेन च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमिन तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातु न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न मे द्वेषरागौ लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखम् न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासङ्गतं नैव मुक्तेन मे चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप
Good evening and good morning. I'm so happy to be here with you guys and to have an opportunity to have this conversation. Let me just see. I have a few questions that came in on via email. And what I'd like to do, I think, is start right now with any questions that you guys who are live on the call have in the gaps and the spaces. We'll get to the questions that I have and also the questions that I assume are going to come in also on the webinar. Deb is, of course, standing by to help us get into conversation with each other. Does anyone have a question that you'd like to start with?
Please raise your hand by pushing star 2. Hold on a sec. We've got someone from Connecticut.
Hello. Who are you? Who is this?
Hi, Sally. I am wondering, before I reveal my name, is it possible to be anonymous? Because this is quite a vulnerable question.
Of course.
I'm happy to reveal it to you in an email just so you're not left in the mystery. But thank you so much. What I want to bring to you is just a real, day-to-day experience. Because on one level, I can hold this non-dual awareness of all that you're sharing with us and have been studying Tantra and non-duality for many, many years, that, and that awareness of this is all a dream and I'm the consciousness experiencing it and witnessing it. But on a day-to-day level, I experience in my human life, the experience of duality, I can experience a lot of despair and a lot of anguish for the gap that I experience between where I am and where I want my life to be on multiple levels. As far as finances and business, relationship or lack thereof, desire for children and lack thereof, and awareness that I'm not getting younger, and just feeling that squeeze of wishing things were different, and that sting of experiencing others having the life I thought I would have by now, and feeling like I'm not where I thought I would be. And, and sometimes it's sort of like that balance between dropping into these meditations versus doing the visualizing and the law of attraction tools and practices. There's so many different realms to play on, versus being surrendered to what is and finding more peace there. So I'm, without saying a lot more, unless you want me to elaborate, I think I'm just really curious, like if you were in my shoes at middle age or, as a student asking you as my teacher right now, how would be the best way to navigate that when in the most immediate, I think the desire is peace and happiness in the now. And yet on the bigger picture, it's like I had dreams and desires that I might not fulfill. And the grief about that.
Yeah. I think we all have experience of this set of issues, as well as the question of whether you go for inner peace, for want of a better word, as your main goal, and how much it is okay and desirable to use your imagination to manifest realities that would be preferable. Would you say that's part of the question? I know. And
it
the
is.
Despair and mm-hmm. Yeah. And the despair question, which is a big one, and which I don't think I can necessarily answer in all its granularity in this forum. But I can say that like everyone else, I recognize it. And obviously just to speak to that first, there are a lot of ways in which our lives don't live up to our dreams. Mm. And to some extent, this is karmic. To some extent, and the more I practice and honestly, the older I get, the more I realize that there is a lot we can do, whether through reframing our understanding of ourselves or reframing our understanding of how we draw into our life the things we want without selling ourselves out to desire, which, as I'm sure you know, is one of the quickest ways there is to feel agitated and bad. First of all, I don't know how much manifestation practice you've done. We're actually about to start, in next week or this coming week on Tuesday, we're going to start the second book of the Shiva Sutras, which essentially is the framework for understanding the power that humans have in the mind. So I do believe, and I have experienced how it's possible to kind of reimagine your life. And, obviously it's different for everybody because we all do have karmic issues that we're dealing with, and sometimes part of the karma that we're dealing with requires us to deal with disappointment. But in terms of, first of all, I don't believe that meditation on the heart and meditation on awareness are inimical or in any way obviate the skillful use of imagination. So in other words, there's a basic spiritual, I would call it spiritual Puritanism, that gives us the idea that the only pure way to be spiritual is to focus entirely on God, to do complete surrender, to make being in the heart and being in awareness your priority. And I believe this comes from a misunderstanding about the levels of humanity. First of all, it's been my experience that meditation, especially if we do it without thinking of it in the ways that lead to spiritual bypassing, that meditation is utterly indispensable for transformation. And that the practices that we're doing here and the other practices that you've done, which I gather from what you said have been a big part of your life for a while, so I'm not right. I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but that these are this is the bottom line. That we can, I wouldn't want to live without it. I wouldn't want to encourage you to live without it. And at the same time, assuming that you've done the self-inquiry practices, the energetic work, the therapeutic practices, or looking at what the beliefs and concepts are that might be at play. I'm not going to ask you whether that's true or not. I'm going to assume it is. And I also believe that every one of us is holding a whole slew of limiting beliefs. I mean, starting with the belief that we're separate from God, starting with the belief that we're limited and small. As you know, that belief, which is very deeply ingrained in our system, is going to be, because it's the default all of the other beliefs that we have about ourselves, and the, you know, the karmic misunderstandings that we all carry, they're undergirded by that feeling of, you know, essential separation and essential duality. And what goes along with it is the belief that there's a certain life that is a good life, and, you know, a deep self-rejection if the life that we're living doesn't live up to that. So beginning to eliminate the sense of separation is actually the main antidote, I feel, and I've experienced for working with, you know, with your karmic issues. And of course, I'm going to say it's never a good idea to compare yourself to anybody else, you know, which is spirituality 101. But none of us can avoid doing that. But I would suggest that you actually do that practice of looking at what you desire, what you deeply desire, and at what you want by getting what you desire. And I suspect that if you do that, you'll come up with a couple of things that are bottom line to your dream in this lifetime. And focus on the one or two that really feel significant, that you sense are part of what you came into this lifetime to experience, to do, to, for want of a better word, achieve. And begin to do the practice of imagining those things in your life. You know, it's, but do it, and I'm sure you know those practices. Do it for a set amount of time, and do it with as much as possible the absolute conviction that you already have what you want. And in that way, because we tend to do, you know, those practices that are loosely subsumed in the law of attraction teachings, we tend to do them with a sense that we don't have them. And we tend to do them bringing in the feeling of depression, despair, longing, nervousness, agitation, whatever it is we bring to it. And the real work, if you're going to do that kind of practice, is teaching yourself how to hold for 5 or 10 minutes at a time. It's enough to start with, to just center yourself in the belief, I am experiencing what it is that I want. You know, I am experiencing a situation where I'm giving my gifts and I'm filled with love, and, you know, I'm succeeding at this thing that is my deepest ambition. You only need to hold it for 5 or 10 minutes to begin with, because, you know, basically, it's very hard for the average person, or even the average spiritually advanced person, to hold a belief that they're imposing on, you know, on the felt sense that what's real is that I don't have a job. Obviously, you can't hold the idea I have a job if I, in the real world, don't have a job for a very long time. But you can hold it for a long enough time to begin to really seed it into your neurophysiological system. In other words, to start a new brain pathway that can, you know, that can help you literally seed that reality into your awareness, and do it, you know, as a game. Do it as an experiment. Do it as something that you're playing with, but while you're doing it, do it with full conviction. So that's, you know, that's what I would say about the manifestation practice. I do believe that manifestation practice works, and I think there are certain circumstances in which it's really important. And yet, we really have to parse it with our greater goals. So does that begin to answer your question,
It definitely does. Yeah, I appreciate that, you know, concrete, tangible practice to play with, and, you know, making slight adjustments to maybe feel more in alignment with it. And what you said around, you know, I think the real heart of my suffering is that what you said exactly, the self-rejection because of all the ways I'm not living up to the hopes and dreams and expectations. And I think that's where the source of the pain really hits home. And, you know, what keeps bringing me back to these practices that you teach is, you know, those places where you see that possibility that when we turn back to the source, that's really the fulfillment that we all seek, that I know in my rational mind, you know, the yeah. seeking out there is going to be an endless, perpetual seeking, and that where you're pointing us back to is where it all actually resides already. Anything, you know, that we could acquire out there and more. So I think that's also the part I want to be nurturing more deeply, simultaneously, in the face of all the seeking and the striving that I am perpetuating. I'm well aware of that. But I think I need to I'm desiring to offset that and maybe
yeah.
outdo that with those inner pointings or turning back on the source of it all.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I would, let me ask you another question, and you might want to think about it. How do you know what you intended for yourself in this lifetime? You know,
yeah.
I mean, what
my ego's telling me, I don't.
Beyond what your ego's telling you, beyond what the society is telling you. I mean, we're living in the midst of the most radical, you know, capitalist crazy society that the world has ever known, as far as I can understand. It's all about individual success as measured by a consumerist capitalist model that we're living in. Not to argue about the goods and evils of capitalism. I mean, there's, you know, a lot to say about it. But I think the really destructive thing that we all have to deal with is this idea that to call ourselves successful, we have to fit the social model. You know, and every one of us grew up with it. Our families probably have their own version of it. But, I mean, can you consider that maybe you came into this life with the intention of setting yourself up in such a way that you are actually able to truly enter into the recognition of your true self? And that in order to do that, for most of us, it involves a certain amount of worldly failure. I mean, that's how it's, you know, that's how it's always been. And that's how I think it is for many of us, that, in other words, we need some, you know, to be really hard-nosed about it. We need a certain amount of stability, economic stability, and social and familial and mental stability to be on the spiritual path. But if we have too much, if we have too much success, if we have too much wealth, then we very often get so caught up in sustaining those things that it's really difficult to do spiritual practice. And a certain amount of heartbreak actually helps us turn to the self. You know, so I think that most people who want a serious spiritual life, I mean, let's say that we are able to choose, to some extent, to choose the life we come into, which I think many of us intuit as more as true to some extent, that why would you not choose a life in which there were challenges that asked you to learn how to love yourself despite the fact that you're not living up to your father's expectations, you know? Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
So you might have, I think it's really interesting to look at the trajectory of your life from the point of view of spiritual awakening and start to recognize that it is actually the perfect trajectory. And I'm pretty sure it is, because every time I've ever looked at this with someone, I include myself, you know, I see that events and, you know, qualities in my life that I would not have chosen or that I would prefer to be different, and qualities in in my character that I would prefer to be different are actually part of the template that has allowed me to put my spiritual life front and center. You know, so honor that. You know, honor that in yourself. Do you know what I mean? Like love that about yourself. Yeah. And then, you know, if you want to do some practical manifestation work, then do it within the framework of abundance, you know, of the abundance that of what you have created in your life and of the awareness that you've brought yourself to. Does that make sense?
It does, right. So from that baseline of acceptance versus resistance to what is.
Yeah, and also even deeper than acceptance, from a baseline of really asking yourself, is it possible that I did this on purpose? You know, is it possible that I created certain blocks or blind spots or challenges in my life because that was what I needed or what I need to actually discover what in me is the deepest truth. And what?
Go ahead.
You know what? I heard something in your sigh. I'm just wondering.
I do want to hear what the content was. That you honestly. But yeah, just kind of dropping. I mean, I can feel where I'm receiving those words. You know, it evokes a lot of emotion. So I trust there's a lot of truth in that, of just the letting go of the self-loathing and the self-rejection and the disappointment and the victimization, really, of feeling like victimized by my circumstances versus at choice and being intentional and deliberate and wow, this is exactly by design and perfect and I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be. Like, it's such a different paradigm to live in.
Don't you think? Yeah. And also to realize that, and this is a very deep shift, to realize that the goddess, the universe, Shakti, is showing up for you in particular ways in order to show you where you're not free. And, you know, to allow you to find the means of freeing yourself in relationship to what you're being shown. And, you know, that's a big topic, which we're not going to get into because I know other people have questions, but you know, just hold for a second this idea, which is very deep in the tantric tradition, of course, and in the non-dual tradition, that the world is mirroring you, you know, and what is it that you're meant to see? I believe that when we have these, you know, these experiences that bring up self-rejection, that what they're showing us is that there's pockets of self-rejection that have probably been triggered by early childhood circumstances that we need to look at and hold. And I want to give you one more piece of this. Which is that in the end, the way we heal these self-rejecting impulses, which everyone has, is by loving them, loving ourselves. And you know, again, that's something that's very hard for most people. But part of the reason that I teach non-dual tantra and that I teach people how to tune into the heart, you know, to the personal heart, which is so much the doorway to the universal heart, which is the place where we get in touch with that which loves us. And really, the more you can bring your self-rejection, wrap it in a ball, make a little icon out of it, and bring it into the heart, and see if you can allow the heart to join with your awareness and create a space around the self-rejection and just hold it, like, you know, as if you were embracing a child that's crying, because this is what will melt it. And it doesn't all, sometimes, you know, we get big dramatic melting experiences. Mostly it's a little bit at a time, but that is the core of healing for these issues.
Thank you.
So I just want to thank you for the question, and we're going to end here so that other people can ask questions, but I think
Absolutely.
It was probably a great question for a lot of people, so thank you for asking it.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for taking your time with that and giving me some stuff to work with.
You're so welcome. So, my dear ones, is anyone else want to raise your hand?
I just opened up someone in maybe Vermont.
Yes.
That had their hand up.
Yes. Can you hear me?
This is
Barry. All right.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi,
Sally. This is Barry. Hi.
Hi,
you know,
Barry.
I have some vague memory that you may have been on my property at one point. Many years
possibly.
Ago.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Although I think I know what you're talking about, and I don't think I was.
All right.
You're talking about one time when Guru Mai visited Vermont.
Yes, I am.
Yes, I wasn't there.
You weren't there. Okay.
I don't think I've been in Vermont since 1970.
Okay. Well, you should come back. It's
but
an
thank
awesome
you.
Place.
I know it is an awesome place. I remember it with great fondness.
Yeah.
But anyway, what's your question?
I was listening today to your talk, which I am so very grateful for, each one of these weekly sessions. And you were explaining as we breathe in to take our breath down to the diaphragm and really fill our lungs. So it felt to me as if we're opening the heart chakra and the solar plexus. And I had this vision of taking it down to the dantian, the second chakra, but I think of them as the same place. At least that's what my intuition tells me. And to take in that sexual energy, the creative, that adds to the depth. You know, also, because you were talking about how, imagine that you're being made love to by awareness and consciousness.
Right.
So
right.
I'm curious as to why that isn't more a part of the teaching or a part of the instructions.
You mean opening the second chakra with the breath, or adding sexual energy?
I think of it. I was feeling like there was a triangle, where the top of the triangle was the line that goes from in front of you through your heart to behind you, and then it goes down through the second chakra and then back up again to in front of you, through your heart, back behind you, and there's this circle that's created.
Is this happening for you in meditation?
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yes, that is, yeah. You know what, one of the things that and it's, you know, it's utterly valid. And what I think is the most important thing about the way I gave the instruction in the last class, because it represents a shift in my own process with the breath, is that you allow the breath to go down before it comes up. And if it, you know, if in your meditation it's going down all the way down to the lower dantian, then, you know, obviously that's perfectly valid and actually a deep breath and a deeply energizing breath. So it looks to me as though something is happening, something is being revealed to you about a particular pattern of the way the energy flows. And there are other circular patterns that I think some of you may have come in contact with in your practice. For instance, when you're working with the vertical breath from the Muladhara chakra up to the crown, and, you know, and into the Sahasrara, into the Dwadashanta, the space above the crown, what will usually happen at a certain point is that a loop will form, a circle will form, you know, so that the energy is coming up and then flowing down around the body or in front of the body or behind the body, so that you begin to feel the energy circulating. And it sounds like that's what's happening for you. So
right,
yes.
A microcosmic orbit. But
it's a microcosm orbit. It's exactly. It's a version of the Ouroboros practice. And again, in my experience, because you have probably trained in the microcosmic orbit and, you know, in Tai Chi and Qigong meditation and Taoist meditation, as have I, that the way it's taught is, you know, it's kind of in one pattern, but actually there are many, many patterns of that orbit which begin to come online, which we begin to experience naturally and spontaneously as our meditation deepens. So the one you're talking about is one of them. If that's real for you, you know, if it's happening spontaneously and it's not an artificial construction, I would say, you know, your system is showing you something very important. And I believe what you're saying. I've had that experience myself, and I've found that it's best with all of these, you know, energetic openings. It's kind of best if you let your system discover it yourself, rather than having somebody tell you this is the right way to meditate. So what I try to do in giving these instructions is give a general direction and try not to make it so specific that somebody whose experience is different is going to get jammed, you know. Yeah. So hopefully for all of you, there's room for the inner creativity of the Shakti flowing through the breath, you know, to open up the centers that want to open in your being at this time. Mm-hmm. You know, because that this practice is meant to open your inner body, but everybody's inner body opens differently at different moments. You know, there are people here who are going right to the Ajna chakra with this practice and just bypassing the heart altogether because that's where the Shakti wants to go for them right now. You know, so I think that's perfect, and thank you. And I just want to have a... Yeah. I'm sorry, finish your sentence.
I bow to you in gratitude.
Oh, well, thank you. I bow to you. You know, and let's just have a shout-out for the creativity of the Shakti. You know, she really orchestrates all this
all right.
in a perfect way.
All right.
Yes.
Shall we do it? Hip, hip, hurrah for the Shakti.
Yes. Hip, hip, hooray for the Shakti.
Yes.
I'm going to take a question. I'm going to take Catherine's question from Germany. She says I'll read it. She says, I experience pure awareness in trees, furniture, stones as a quiet, breathless existence. Also in me, when I let it, meaning awareness, look through my eyes. At the same time, I also experience a form of distance in that moment. And some of you may have that experience also. However, if I take the door through the heart and color, in quotes, the awareness with the vibrating sweetness of my heart, this is, of course, also reflected in my perception of the objects. I wonder, one, if I am, quote, deluding myself when I put this heart filter in front of my perception. Something in me resists the dry distance perception of the world and the events in this world through pure awareness, as I often feel it. And also, in regard to my teaching and my leading to awareness, if the hearts of people are not opened at the same time, I am concerned that this may not be a blessing to this world if we practice being heartlessly aware. Or do I underestimate the power of pure awareness, which opens hearts at the same time as it emerges? If there were people you know, if we were all in the same room, I would ask if other people have this experience of meditating on pure awareness, creating a distancing, kind of over-detached experience, whereas when you drop into the heart and look through the heart or experience awareness through the heart, there's just more love in it, more tenderness in it. And I have to say this has historically been my experience, and it's one of the reasons why I, you know, generally emphasize tuning into the heart as a, you know, really indispensable part of non-dual practice. I think what you're experiencing is not self-delusion, but really a matter of calibrating awareness with love, which even though paradoxically awareness and love are not different, for most of us they become separated. And I believe the reason that they become separated is because we generally approach awareness through the intellect, which, as we know, tends to be distancing. So I would recommend, and it's partly what we were talking about in the class last week when we talked about the way the Shaiva sages look at the heart. You know, if you remember, in the tradition, the heart is a name for God. It's a name for the highest, but it's a name for the highest, which is based on the understanding that in the true experience of the heart, awareness and love are completely united, and the world is experienced as being held in that heartful awareness, which is never detached, but which experiences a kind of tender connection with the objects of perception and also with yourself. So while it's incredibly important, as you know, and very much at the heart of this teaching, that we learn to become aware of awareness to an extent that we can become aware of awareness anytime. You know, it becomes a familiar recognition for us. I would also say that as it were, stationing yourself in the heart center, in the great heart behind you, or in the inner heart, will allow you to experience pure awareness without that distancing. So, you know, Catherine, what you're doing is, I think, absolutely right on. So continue, please. And in working with students, you know, it obviously you really need to have a sense of where people are at when you give them awareness practices and heart practices. But again, my intuition is that it's never a mistake to allow people to begin by centering themselves in the heart, and you know, so that we begin to tune into the heart center. And also, as you do that, if you're teaching heart-centered meditation, people are going to experience the wounds of the heart and the emotions that are, you know, that are part of our, of, you know, let's say the human aspect of the heart, what I call the emotional heart. Those things are going to come up. And, you know, as a teacher, your job is really to help people hold them. And to reassure people that, you know, that the experience of your emotional wounding is part of the process of entering the heart, and it's not going to be permanent. In other words, you can sit within your heart and learn how to let the emotions come up and dissolve. And doing that will give you a deeper and deeper faith in the power of the heart to hold your historical wounds, and also to serve as the doorway into the great heart, into your deep love. So I think is really the answer to your question about students. Don't worry so much about whether their hearts are open. Help them get into a position where the heart can naturally open. And three, awareness itself will eventually open the heart as well as every part of your being. And yet, I think that skillful practice means that you work with the different centers of the body rather than really expecting awareness to reveal the fullness of what it is immediately. Because for most people, it doesn't. You know, for most people, really have to return again and again and again to the practice of being aware of awareness and learning how to return to awareness in the midst of life, in the midst of stressful situations. And it's much easier to do this if you're also cultivating a heart practice or a central channel practice or some connection to your own embodied subtlety. So part of the skill of being a yoga teacher or a meditation teacher is to help people really connect to the heart while continually reminding them that awareness is the deepest truth. And it might feel a little bit like patting your belly and rubbing your head at the same time, but actually it's a skill that all of us are learning in this process, and that's, I find, to be one of the most valuable skills that meditation can teach us. So thank you, Catherine.
Sally, Jane asked on the webcast, I'm thinking you may have kind of answered this question, but she asked, why do we focus attention on the heart center and other centers from a space behind the physical body?
Okay, really good question. Mainly because it's been my experience that, let's call it the ego-driven mind, the part of us that identifies primarily with our individuality in the egoic sense. You know, my name is Sally, and I'm a woman, and I live in Carmel Valley, California, and I have this, I have these traits in this family, etc. That the tendency of that part of the self is constantly to move forward, to look outward, and that when we turn our attention backward and tune into ourselves behind the body, that it literally turns us back to the underlying self. It's a way of interiorizing consciousness that I have simply found over the years is very, very powerful. So I really do it because it kind of changes our sense of where we sit, where we station ourselves. And because it's a very unexpected way of self-identifying. And also because, again, in my experience, especially when moving through life and moving through the stressful situations of life, there is something extremely powerful and empowering about finding yourself behind your body. It begins to dissolve your identification with the body, which is a limiting identification, and I'm not saying that embodying is a bad idea. Of course we should all embody, but we also need to train ourselves in recognizing that our body is not simply what's inside our skin. Our body is also our subtle body, which is, you know, the subtle body is arm's length distance for most of us, beyond the physical body, and it is the place where we have resources and empowerments and even more than that, connections to the helpful energies of the subtle world, to deity energies, to helping spirits. They tend to become available to us through the subtle body. So when you meditate in the heart behind the body, you're really opening yourself to recognizing how much larger you are as an individual than what you normally think of yourself as being. And secondly, it's a way of opening to higher energies. And I would say beyond that, that as you get more and more skillful in being present to your subtle body, to this much larger body, what you also begin to notice, and this is to answer some other questions that have come up, it also allows you to to create a kind of protective boundary around your physical body. So at the edges of the subtle body, you know, and which again, if you haven't done this, you can find by stretching your arms out on either side and just imagining a circle that surrounds your body that's as wide as your two outstretched arms. And begin to imagine that there's a bright, you know, red, orange, magenta, golden light around this bubble that is your subtle body. And feel that light is actually protecting you, protecting your open consciousness, protecting your loving vulnerability against negative energies. So as we recognize we're bigger than the physical body, as we learn how to construct a light boundary around that wide, subtle body, we become more and more confident in opening ourselves, you know, in letting our consciousness expand, because we become more and more confident that we're protected, that, you know, nothing unpleasant or untoward is going to come into our field. So that's why, that's a long answer to your question. That's why I'd like to encourage you to meditate behind the body.
Are you ready for another question from the
podcast? Yes.
Okay, so this is from Desi. She's in London, and she unfortunately couldn't join us tonight, but she had posted a question, and it kind of relates to someone else that asked a similar question. So she said, "Dearest Sally and Sangha, I have felt very immersed in the Hamsa and the Great Heart, and I am experiencing moments of profound expansion, connection, and unity. My question is that I am having trouble remaining in the Great Heart when challenged with wrong action, whether small acts like witnessing a parent watching his young child torment pigeons, or on the grander scale, the multiplicity of atrocities occurring, shootings, child abuse, genocide. I realize it's the action which is horrendous, not the awareness or soul. But I do still experience embodied contraction, which distances me from the expansive Great Heart when confronted with ignorant and wrong action. Although this contraction occurs when challenged personally by those who wish me harm, how do I protect myself and still remain expansive, especially when removing myself from this situation is impossible, in my case, family members? If all is Shakti, some of what is manifested is hard to bear witness to. It is easy to connect to unity in the neutral and positive, but my heart tells me the deep lessons is being able to remain awake and in the Big Heart when faced with challenges, pain, and ignorance. Sally, I would appreciate your wisdom in working with this challenge."
Yes, so welcome to the world. I'm not laughing because what your question is funny, but because I think what you said is the challenge that everyone faces. So first of all, the practice that I just talked about, that I just offered in response to Jane's question, is a very, very important part of, as it were, subtly armoring yourself so that you can handle the negativity. And as you do that, as you begin to station yourself in the bigger heart and to be aware that yourself is much bigger than the body, it really does strengthen your capacity to remain expansive. And I would say there's a few things, assuming that you can't remove yourself from the situation, there's a few things that really make a difference. One of them is actually noticing the physical symptoms of contraction. You know, usually when our heart is contracted or when we feel that a lot of negative energy is coming towards us, we physically tense in order to protect ourselves against it. And, you know, as you know from if you've ever done Tai Chi, that the heart of working with negative energies is actually to approach it from a place of relaxation. So one of the first practices that you can learn to work with when you're faced with something that feels unbearable is to notice where the physical tensions is and the physical tensions are and relax them, breathe into them and relax them, and actually give yourself some attention there. You know, it's a soothing practice. It's a powerful self-healing practice. Most people have manifold tensions in the body, of course, and the work of releasing them, relaxing them, softening them is an ongoing process. But if you start to do this with the physical body, it helps a lot. And another practice is to offer blessings. You know, when you're, and again, this requires centering yourself, taking a deep breath, perhaps moving into the back heart, perhaps noticing the contractions and releasing them, and then have the intention to offer a blessing to the person who's behaving in this way, and you'll find a way. I know you will, because you know you're very good with imagining good outcomes. You'll find a way to word a blessing so that it's true to the situation you're facing. I mean, whether you're saying, please accept blessing, you know, to calm down so that you can stop yelling at your child, or, you know, may these areas of horror be transformed. I mean, that is one of the things that we can effectively do. And the thing I would say is that, you know, noticing your aversion, noticing your fear, noticing your contraction is the first step towards healing it. And it's also very disconcerting to realize how fragile our open states are. But the more you can notice it, and the more you can work with a few of these methods for, in the moment, opening the contraction physically, and then working with your matrika, the practice of sending blessings. You know, Rumi says, you know, in one of his poems, he talks about making offerings from the heart. And he says, even if your heart feels dry and contracted, make the offering anyway. And Rumi says, because God in his mercy accepts bad coin. In other words, even if your prayer or your blessing is insincere, it's still going to make a difference, and it will especially make a difference to your heart. So those are my suggestions. What you're talking about is absolutely the universal human experience for people on the spiritual path. You know, for so many of us, you're sitting in meditation and you're completely open and expanded, and then you get up, walk out of the room and into the kitchen, and there's some family member who says something that triggers you, and you completely lose your state. This is life. This is how. And that moment when you choose to meet the trigger with inner work, not expecting yourself to be completely immune to it, but looking at it as something you can work with, this is how sadhana begins to permeate every moment of life. So again, thank you for that great question. Deb, do we have...
Do you want to take another? Yeah, do you want to take another? We have someone in California, maybe, calling from a cell phone in California.
Okay.
Okay. You're on?
Yes. Yeah. Hi, this is Lakshmi.
Hi. Hi, Lakshmi.
Hi. So I wanted to ask about... So my father entered hospice about 2 months ago, and which is, I feel in some ways blessed to have taken your living and dying class earlier this year. But as I'm working with, you know, there's just profound waves of sadness that will come up. And, you know, I'm familiar yeah. with how to be present with them and stay with the sensations and how that will move if I cannot get stuck in a thought pattern or thought wave. I'm wondering about how to work with awareness, with particularly with that experience of sadness, because, you know, and I'm in therapy and I've been doing a lot of things and body work and, you know, try to work with the grief. And but when I go into a place of awareness, it pulls me out of that experience, and in a way that I'm just curious about, like, what level is that spiritual bypassing? You know, I don't think it's avoidance, but it completely changes the experience, and I become, you know, so much greater and kind of drop into a such a spaciousness, and it just feels kind of counterintuitive, I guess. And I wanted to just ask you to speak about that a little.
I would say, do you believe that you have a duty to your father to be sad about his dying? I mean, you don't have to answer that question, but I think it's worth looking at.
I think some of it is, I don't know, there's not taking responsibility for his bad decisions, which were mostly, you know, the root of the situation, although there's some regret that I have, but I couldn't have done anything differently than I did. So I don't think it's as much a duty to be sad. I mean, I think it's sadness for the choices that he made. You know, it's hard. So there's a lot of times I'm just really, the last time I visited him yesterday, I'm just really trying to station myself in the heart and not speak very much. And not even go into his heart, but just really stay in my heart. And back heart. I don't know. That's what's interesting is I think when I go into awareness, it takes me out of the sadness and it doesn't entirely feel wrong, but it was, I guess I was surprised by that.
Well, my experience of really being centered in awareness is that it will often dissolve painful emotions in the moment. And
yeah.
We have to use it skillfully because clearly, you know, we don't want to kind of reify awareness in a way that we're using it as a bypass not to feel. But I don't think that's your problem, Lakshmi. I mean, I think you have through your practice you've developed a capacity to be in awareness in this very challenging situation, and you're experiencing some of the fruits of it. I'll tell you, my own, one of the reasons that I think it's so important for everyone to cultivate awareness of awareness, you know, there's many reasons for it, one of them being that it is a straight-up, direct doorway into God. But another reason is that it gives you a place to be when everything in your life is going wrong. You know, that actually lets you make better decisions. It lets you be less emotional. You know, it's very important to be able to tune into that awareness of awareness space because it puts everything in perspective. So I think it's a gift. I think it's great.
Yeah, I think, you know, or maybe you can speak more about her. I'm not even sure if it's right for me to ask you that question when you said, do I feel like I have a duty to be sad around my father's dying? And I don't even know. I think maybe that's one of those those deep, you know, some scars you were asking us to kind of, a deep thought pattern that you were asking us to look at, you know, what's really true, what's underneath that. Because of all the practice, I feel like I kind of can't believe actually how well I'm doing given everything that's happening. And it almost,
well, you know,
there's not guilt, but.
Yeah, well, I think there may be a little guilt.
Yeah.
I don't want to put thought, you know, emotions in your field, mm-hmm. but again, just from what I know about my own experience and, you know, and the experience mm-hmm. of others is that we have an expectation in these situations, which can be any kind of expectation. I mean, some people's expectation might be, I'm going to be stalwart and I won't get all upset and I'll, you know. Other people's expectation may be, I'm going to completely fall apart, and if I don't, it means I don't love the person. You know, so it's very helpful just to look at what your expectations are of how, as a good daughter, you know, and I know you've done a lot of work with him during this whole process, mm-hmm. and it hasn't, it's been challenging, you know. So I think you can say I've been doing a really good job of showing up and dealing with my own resistances, and I've done a lot of inner work, and, you know, and the way I'm handling it is right. You know what I mean? It's good. It's a sign that I've made some spiritual progress.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful to hear, because the awareness did. did feel good, and then there's times where it felt like, okay, it's okay for me to stay with the sadness a little bit longer before I go there. So thank you.
Yeah, and you'll go back and forth too. You know, you can't. Yeah. Sadness will come, and yeah, you don't want to push it away, but you don't.
Yeah.
You don't need to wallow in it. It's
thank
not
you so
callous.
Much. I yeah. Thank
you're
you.
Welcome.
I okay. wouldn't be able to do any of this without all of your sharing. So thank you so much.
Oh, sweetie, you're so welcome, and thank you for being so real. So I see two hands, one in Eugene, Oregon, and one in Seattle. So I think we take these two questions. We're a little bit after our accustomed time. So hello.
This is Laura.
Can you hear me?
In Seattle.
Hi, Laura. Hi, Laura. How are you?
I had a visual when meditating on Shiva on the third eye. And I was thinking about the third eye that came above my mom when she passed. And I'm embarrassed to say this, but also the yoni. I don't want to be embarrassed. Mm-hmm. I think it should be connected. But I realized they're all the same shape. The opening.
Yeah.
The cosmic wisdom. And I thought, well, why, if it's a third eye, why isn't it, you know, in the regular position? It is shaped in the position of the yoni on a female. And also the shape that showed above my mom when she passed of pure light. Can you help me understand
this? So the shape, the shape that you see is an almond shape.
Yes, but
or
not
a circle.
Not
yeah.
horizontal. It's vertical.
Vertical. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
it's on
yeah.
Shiva's forehead in this course.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
most deities
yeah.
too.
Yeah. Well, it is. I mean, it is.
Okay.
That's how it is. And I think that's actually a really good insight that, you know, the yoni and the third eye are obvious, you know, they're the same shape as, you know, in nature, there are shapes that mirror each other, you know, and that great is a great statement that's it's one of the Shiva Sutras, as here, so elsewhere, you know, or,
oh, wow.
My guru used to say that what is here is also there. What is not here is nowhere, which is mm-hmm. a way of recognizing that the universe is inside you. But, you know, Shiva and Shakti exist in every part of the body, but they're also particularly at certain polarities of the body. And if you look at the sexual organs in both men and women, you'll see similar shapes, and you know that there's an eye in the penis, the yoni is an eye, the third eye is an eye, and they're vertically shaped. That's how they look.
Okay.
So
since I get it, can I go to my second question, which is from
sure.
your guru and the person who initiated me? Guru Dev said, "That's not you, not you. It's bhava, a fleeting condition. Aha, it's not you." I found it very difficult to understand what he meant when he said, "That's not you, not you, aha, it's not you." I spent a week arguing with myself about its meaning, and even then, I didn't understand it. So I had an uprising with a long-term friend around someone speaking very badly about people all the time, and I asked them to go. Please, don't come back. And I don't know if that's what happens when anger comes up, when people speak badly about others so much?
Okay, so what she's, for everyone else, she's quoting from a passage in Swami Muktananda's autobiography, Play of Consciousness, in which he talks about how when he was with his guru, he used to meditate on his guru, and he noticed that during that period, a lot of anger would come up. Now, what his guru was saying to him in that moment is the anger that comes up in you is not the result of your own, you know, dysfunctional emotional self. It is the result of meditating on me, his guru Nityananda, which is activating a quality in the universe that that manifests anger as a way of changing energy, basically. So yes, there are circumstances in which we hear ourselves saying things that sound angry but that aren't coming from our personal emotional anger, but are, you know, a way that truth comes to us. And I think we all have that experience sometimes. And it's often very hard to tell, because not every angry outburst is, you know, is coming from that higher place. Some of them are coming from your, you know, your personal unprocessed anger. So it's interesting to start to look at that and to start to discern. And I would say one of the ways that I discern, and love and blessings to you, Laura. I think it's beautiful that this feels emotional to you. But what?
So much love.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. So it's beautiful. So the question really is it clean burning? I mean, can that anger, or can that sharpness, because what we're talking about is not anger, but sharpness. Can that sharpness come out, be directed at its target, and then leave no emotional residue in you? That's what that Vajra sharpness is really about. And, you know, because we doubt ourselves, there will always be questions. But if you can find the first moment after it leaves your mouth and discern the difference between clean burning sharpness and, you know, there's another thing that often accompanies angry outbursts. There's a kind of satisfaction to saying, you know, to letting rip that way, that is not clean burning anger. It's an aspect of egoic anger, and what we need to learn to do is discern the difference. And nobody can do that but you, you know, because other people
strange as I woke up, and the person I woke up and just said, "You regret saying what you said." I said, "I have no regret." It felt like I'm going to cry again. It felt like the guru. It didn't feel like me.
Yeah.
And what I knew was that I stood up to a bully, and I've never done that in my life, like so clean, so sharp. And I do know that.
Well, yay for you. That's fantastic. That's fantastic. Or you could say, you know, it's you're leaving behind, you know, the nice girl thing, that a nice boy thing. It's not just restricted to women. You're leaving behind that. You know, and learning to. Yeah, you're so welcome. So
yeah, okay.
Okay, love. So I let's just take one more. Let's take the person.
In Eugene. Okay, Deb. I just opened that.
Yeah, the person in Eugene.
Yep.
Hi,
yeah.
Sally. It's Wendy.
Hi, Wendy.
Hey. Thanks for really so much information. I'll have to listen to it over and over again. But I thought that it might be nice for you to say a little bit more. So I've also done a lot of that studying about death with you, and was really relieved actually how we added this awareness of awareness on top of that. And truthfully, at like the kind of loss where it's not just loss of other but of self. What I found is that the only space at all that has any redemption whatsoever is in those little tiny moments, glimmers, where awareness in the heart sort of moves beyond time.
Yeah.
And I know I've asked you about this personally, but I always think lately about that teaching you gave about Bhairava, about how, like, you know, that's like the frightening face of God, and how when we're most frightened, we, like, turn to that deep space.
Yeah.
Because there's no place else to go.
Exactly.
But it's, like, weird because you can't always find the door, you know?
And all
well,
I
you can always,
about
yeah.
is just pray to be changed. So that's
well,
like totally
I love that
like
prayer.
Complete surrender. Well, that was what you told me to pray.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to end this call with so much grief, but I feel like at the heart of it, and I just wish you could say something about this, like the deepest awareness of awareness is in this transition space between life and death.
Yeah,
how
it
we
is.
Move
it's
between
right.
these lives and how we let go of people.
Yeah.
But I can't, like, maybe then I'm just deluded, and that's just me making myself believe that, but that doesn't feel right. I think it's the truth,
well,
but I don't really get it.
I think it, you know, first of all, we haven't really talked about that much in this course, but you're aware of it, and a lot of you here are aware of this teaching, the teaching of the Madhya, the center, you know, the place between one activity and another. The biggest one is between life and death.
Yeah.
And you know, the Madhya, it's kind of like, it's a little bit like the black hole into which everything dissolves, and within which, I mean, it's not, who knows what a physical black hole is like, but, you know, in human consciousness, it's like all of the doubts, all of the identifications, in the moment that you're able to be in the space between, you know, between one breath and another, between one thought and another, and between one life and another, that it's kind of like all bets are off. There's pure
yeah.
awareness, pure love, and, you know, and it is the truth.
Mm.
You know, but out of that, because, you know, I'm going to put this in metaphysical terms, because Shakti is always creating newness.
Yeah.
You know, and she's always creating experience. So you're not going to be able to stay in that state very long at this point. But as you practice and as your ability to remain in awareness or to remain in the Madhya or to remain in the heart becomes greater and greater over time, which is, you know, as you know it does, then the wisdom of emptiness, you know, the wisdom of the empty fullness starts to answer these questions. And because these questions are only, they're answered as realizations. They're answered as openings. They're answered as revelation because they are beyond the mind. You know, just as death is beyond what we can understand when we're living.
Yeah,
somebody
in this class said to me, she's been my partner, Vicky. She always writes such beautiful things, but she said, the only thing to do is to pray and give thanks and grace to, like, every moment you feel it. It's like the only way
yeah.
to come closer to it again. So I'm trying.
Yeah.
I'm
yeah.
trying, and I'm really grateful for this time close to you again.
Yeah.
Thanks, Sally.
Yeah. Oh, Wendy, you're so welcome. I would like to answer Ritu's question, which is, but she asked some really great questions. I'm going to try and answer them on Tuesday. They're questions about, you know, free will and divine will, those great questions. But one thing that she asked, and I want to say it on the call before we end, one of her questions was about how tuning into the great heart, into the heart center as a space of quiet is difficult because she's feeling the heartbeat. And although meditating on the physical heart is actually quite a profound practice on its own, the practice that we are working with is really about is, as it were, bypassing the physical heart, meditating on the heart center to the right and going through that door. Because it's true that when you're meditating in the physical heart, the expansion and contraction, the diastole, systole and diastole, I think they're called, the experience of the heart chambers opening and closing, becomes it really takes your full attention. And there's a way to meditate in the physical heart where you move in between the beats, but it's much easier for most of us to meditate on what Ramana Maharshi calls the spiritual heart, which is to the right of the spiritual heart. So if anyone else has that question, that's the answer that I would offer as a practice hint. So I will answer to some of your other questions during the class on Tuesday. And I want to thank you all for showing up for this and for these fantastic questions. People have asked such great questions and shared such great depth of intention and heart. So it's really a joy and honor for me to be with all of you in all these calls and on the listserv and in every other way. And I'll see you on Tuesday. Thank you so much. Have a beautiful evening or day. So much love to all of you. Good night.